Well, good morning again. You guys have been a great audience, and I am grateful for my colleagues' presentations and to be a part of this panel. This presentation is called Can the FDA Be an International Police Force? So we're going to talk a little bit about the domestic and international drug supply, the entities that supervise that supply, and the safety concerns that are becoming more and more prevalent in both the U.S. and the international drug supply, and some things that are being done to try and address those concerns. I do not have any financial relationships to disclose. And I'm going to start with a couple statistics from last year's WHO report. It turns out we spend $75 billion each year on the global pharmaceutical market, and that a minimum of 10% of that spending is lost to corrupt practices. So we're talking about a minimum of $75 billion lost every year. In addition, part of this problem is that over 10% of medicines sold in developing countries are counterfeit. Now, other studies have said that these counterfeits enter the markets of up to 90 different countries, and that they could, in fact, kill up to 700,000 people each year. Also, the growth rate is shocking. It turns out that the number of counterfeit drugs entering the market each year are double the rate of the amount of legitimate drugs entering the market. So not only is this a broad problem, it's growing rapidly. How do we get here? The U.S. pharmaceutical industry started back in the mid-1800s, and at that time, there was very little regulation, almost nothing. It was very much a buyer beware philosophy. There were no restrictions on the ingredients lists. You didn't have to issue warnings, dosage. You could pretty much put anything on the market. You could even claim it was a cure-all, and people would buy it, and people were buying it, right up until 1905, when there started to be some questions about safety. And this slide shows the center spread of a publication called Collier's Weekly. And from 1905 to 1906, they published a number of articles highlighting some of the dangers of that existed in the current pharmaceutical market. There was a public reaction. People started to become very concerned. Researchers and social activists made public presentations, and people started demanding that something happen, that there be some regulation. And so there was. The U.S. government responded with the 1906 Pure Food and Drugs Act. This act said for the first time that you cannot manufacture, sell, or transport dangerous medicines within the United States. It also said, shockingly, for the very first time, that you have to label dangerous ingredients, including alcohol, cannabis, morphine, cocaine, and heroin. You could still put them in any medicine, but you now had to label it. After this legislation went through, the sale of drugs with these opiates included reduced by 33%. So it was a successful act. But then in 1937, something happened. A product called sulfanilamide entered the market, and this contained an active ingredient that was actually known to harm humans. The research had been done, and unfortunately, the company that produced it, S.E. Massengill, did not do research before they put this drug on the market. They did not realize that this active ingredient was, in fact, harming people. And so 107 people die. Again, the public is outraged, and they demand for stricter regulations. The FDA responds. And so with this U.S. Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, now you need to label the ingredients, the directions, and the side effects. You have to have evidence of safety before the drug enters the market. You have to set tolerances to prevent overdoses. And you also, and the FDA also now has the power to enforce penalties upon pharmaceutical companies that don't follow these standards. So it's really the formation of the FDA at the beginning of the century, which continues. And unfortunately, I don't have time to go through all of these acts, but each of them show new legislation being passed to enforce certain regulations in the pharmaceutical industry and to raise the responsibility and the role of the FDA. So now we're entering the 21st century, and the problems that we're facing now are more with post-market surveillance, because there's a very vast amount of pharmaceuticals entering our market, as you can see from this chart. North America consumes over 50% of the global supply of pharmaceuticals. In addition, 80% of our drugs have ingredients that are imported. 40% of the drugs themselves are imported to the United States, and we import from 150 countries. So the FDA's job is expanding. They have a lot more to supervise. A New England Journal of Medicine study between 2002 and 2007 looked at the FDA facility inspections and found that they had conducted 11,000 inspections in this five-year period. Unfortunately, less than 13% of these inspections were happening at the foreign facilities. So if you have a domestic facility, you might get a visit from an FDA official every 2.7 years, but if that facility is international, you won't see an FDA official for 13 years. 87% of inspections are being done domestically, even though 80% of the ingredients are produced internationally. It's a concern. Another concern comes as a result of the out-of-pocket expenses that we're spending in the United States. In 2008, 41% of Americans spent over $1,000 on their medical expenses, and a great deal of these expenses were directly going to pharmaceutical products. So in response, the United States consumer has started to look to internet pharmacies, mail order pharmacies. They have reduced costs incredibly. I'm actually staying with a family here in Denver who has a Wellbutrin prescription, and they've saved $2,000 already this year. So imagine if you have multiple prescriptions and multiple people in your family purchasing drugs. It really makes sense to go to the internet, except that there are multiple safety concerns. And the FDA has issued some warnings about this. They have said that they've said that you could be encountering counterfeit drugs through the internet, dangerous ingredients, expired drugs that have been relabeled. There may not have been a safety check or an effectiveness check. They may not have been shipped or stored correctly. And the FDA wants to step in and help with this issue, but in 2000, they tried to pass the Internet Prescription Drug Sales Act, and it did not pass. In 2007, there was an attempt to pass the Safe Internet Pharmacy Act, and it did not pass. And so now you have a market, and the FDA estimates that about 60% of the drugs consumed through or purchased through online pharmacies are counterfeit, fraudulent, or adulterated. And so the U.S. is consuming $3 million in substandard drugs through the internet each year. The supply chain. Some of my colleagues have talked a little bit about this very complicated supply chain. We have repackagers, distribution centers, manufacturers, retail pharmacies. All these people touch your drugs before they get to your medicine cabinet. And so there's a concern because not only is this very intricate supply chain domestic, but it's now also international. There's a lot to surveillance that we have to address. So we have a broken system. We have a number of very effective, powerful, useful drugs, and we have a number of substandard drugs, and we have a lot of money, $75 billion going into it each year. So what is being recommended? In 2007, Bush signed the FDA Amendments Act. This act said that now we have to have standards to identify, validate, and track prescription drugs. We're going to start having a standard numerical identifier system, and we are going to give the FDA more resources and facilities to secure the drug supply chain. An excellent act, a needed act, and unfortunately the response has been, well, this is wonderful, but can the FDA actually do it? Particularly with number two, the SNI, we can put those on the pharmaceuticals produced in the United States, but can we put them on the pharmaceuticals produced internationally? We don't have that authority at this time. In 2009, the FDA Globalization Act was suggested after heparin from China killed 81 people and caused 785 serious injuries. There's a recall on this product, and it drew attention to the safety of the supply again. So Representative Dingell from Michigan suggested this act. He said that we should have a registry of all facilities, both internationally and domestically. We should increase the registration fees for these facilities so that we can fund inspections. We should have required inspections of the facilities every 2 years, not 13. And the FDA should have stronger enforcement tools so that they can destroy the counterfeits and also impose penalties and jail time to counterfeiters. This act remains on the books. It's been there since 2009, and it will be under review in January at the 111th congressional session. There is an opinion that it will probably not be passed, and there's a number of reasons for that, but it's an example of something that's being attempted to help solve this problem. Another act was suggested in 2010, just in August. This was in response to a secret recall that happened. Johnson & Johnson decided that they realized that one of the ingredients in Motrin was not dissolving correctly, and so instead of issuing a public recall, they sent out their employees to 5,000 pharmacies to buy up all the Motrin supplies. And the FDA knew. And the FDA said, well, we told them to issue a recall, but the FDA's recall power stops at that. They can only suggest a recall to the manufacturer. They might issue a public warning, but they don't have recall authority. So this act is trying to come in and say, we need to allow the FDA power to recall dangerous drugs. We can't rely on industry to do it. Now, all of these things are being suggested, but we have to look beyond the United States because we're dealing with an international problem. And so let's look beyond. The WHO has initiated a number of pharmaceutical initiatives since 1977. And again, I don't have time to go through all of them, but you can see they have been working on protecting the consumer's global supply. They've advised on effective and safe pharmaceutical products and drugs. And I do want to draw attention to the last one, IMPACT, which just came about a few years ago. This is the International Medical Products Anti-Counterfeiting Task Force. There are 15 countries that are a member of this task force. They have conducted enforcement activities in Egypt, Tanzania, and Uganda. They've addressed illegal internet sales. They've actually made some arrests and seized the drugs themselves. But the problem with all of this is that it's simply not enough. These task forces and forums are not well-funded, and they don't really have formal authority in all of the nations that where counterfeits are affecting. And so the intention is there, but the funding and the authority and the political will may not be. In 1999, the Rockefeller Foundation called together these three bodies, the WHO, the WTO, and the drug industry heads, and they said, we need to do something. We need to have an international drug policy. We need to have stricter intellectual property rights, clinical trial standards, and a harmonized regulatory process. And all these parties agreed, indeed, we need this. And nothing has happened. Part of the reason is a lack of collaboration. The WHO has more formal muscle than the WTO has more formal muscle than the WHO, but they've really been focused more on intellectual property rights and protecting pharmaceutical companies. They do have a mandate to address consumer safety, but again, their focus has been more on TRIPS and the intellectual property rights of pharmaceutical companies. They say that there has been collaboration between the WHO and the WTO, but until date, there is still no formal agreement between these parties. And so we still have these problems rising. So we come back to the two bodies that have made strides in the international safety. This is a chart that was created by the Hudson Institute. It's an American conservative think tank. It's been around since 1961. And basically, I want you to focus on the final line of this, where it says that the FDO is an advocate for its pre-qualified drugs. And what the Hudson Institute is saying is the WHO is not qualified to supervise the international pharmacy scene because they're biased. They will only be passing their pre-qualified drugs and pushing those if they are doing drug surveillance programs. Now, whether or not you agree with this is another issue. The FDA is also under criticism. In 1992, they passed the Drug User Fee Act, and this said that the pharmaceutical industry must submit fees for new drug applications to the FDA. This has raised suspicion from the public, who says, well, now maybe the industry is the FDA's client and not the consumer. Maybe there's more focus on the industry needs and not the consumer safety. And so both parties are being questioned. The conclusion is that the global pharmaceutical safety must improve. Why? As we've mentioned at the beginning, $75 billion is lost to corrupt practices each year, and over 10% of drugs sold in developing nations are counterfeit. Potentially 700,000 people are killed each year from these substandard drugs, and the problem is worsening. Who do we call upon to address this? Should it be the WHO or the WTO? Should we ask the pharmaceutical industry to regulate their supplies? Or do we call on the FDA and other national regulatory bodies? And whatever you select, how do we do this? Do we fund them? How do we fund them? Do we increase political will? How do we empower these parties? How do we get them to work together if they need to work together? Or do we just need to create a new global regulatory power to address these problems? Whatever your answer is and opinion is, it is an issue of timing. Representative Dingell, who suggested that 2009 Globalization Act, says every few months brings another crisis, and really the time to act is now. Thank you.
I'd just like to thank the panel. You were all fabulous. And I'd like to, for those of you who came in a little later, anybody who would like to be on a list, please give me your card. The traffic is really, really light. We just send out a few things about APHA and pharmaceuticals for anybody who's interested in those issues. Also, I passed around a Trade and Health Forum flyer, which, among other things, tells you about a session tomorrow at 10:30 in the Corbell Ballroom, which deals with pharmaceuticals also. So I'd now like to open up for questions to the panelists. Sure.
Okay, so I've been told that I need to speak at the microphone so it gets recorded. So the question is, in the work that I've done, have I identified diversions or counterfeits? I have not worked on counterfeits. I am not a pharmacist. And so I don't do that. I rely on the pharmacists or the people that are approving who we're buying from to handle that. That's a limit that I have. In terms of diversion, yeah. And I think that that's the whole reason that I'm doing the work that I'm doing and trying to triangulate, is I'm always checking, you know, this is what this clinic is saying that they're using, but do their patient numbers make that, does that make sense? So, you know, there was one time in the Congo that the one clinic had been given five bottles of Cotrimoxazole, and that should have lasted them for a month, and they called 2 weeks later to say that mysteriously three of the bottles had disappeared. And so we went and we looked at their patient records and we had a little chat with them, and you know, we discovered that something had gone walking someplace. But that's exactly the point of what I'm trying to do, is just that one data source alone doesn't give you enough information, but if you look at it from multiple ways, you can sometimes find out where things got lost. Okay, so first off, please call me Libby. And second off, so I tried actually not to go down that tirade. One of the things that drives me crazy is that somebody up here thinks, oh, well, the nurse can just tabulate all this data. You know, she's only seeing 560 patients during the day. Surely she can stay an extra 4 hours at night and do all of this stuff. And this is one of the reasons why I said, based on the size of the facility, you just need somebody who is paid to do this, whose job it is to tally the data. And by the way, the most luck I've had is by doing something wacky, like hiring an accountant. They're really good with numbers, okay? You know, and you know, why not? You can teach them what they need. There are various NGOs that do training on supply chain. I can talk to you about this. I don't know how much time we have left. In terms of tools, computers aren't always the answer, right? I do have a background in computer science, and I always say you have to walk before you can run. You don't want to give somebody a computerized system if the power is going to be out 3 days a week. You need to have a backup paper system or a backup system that will run when the power is out. Personally, I've come up with some really, with what I think are fairly decent tally sheets, or sets of tally sheets, so a daily tally sheet and then a weekly tally sheet that the total gets copied onto, and then a monthly tally sheet that you can move on from there, something like that. But I've done it by working with the staff in the facility to see if they like it and if it makes sense to them and to find out how they think about it. But I can also talk to you afterwards.
In a disaster context, what you find often is that you're relying on a volunteer healthcare force. So you're relying on doctors who volunteered for a medical mission for 1 week, 2 days, 3 days, 5 days, a nurse who's going to be there three, and they're rotating in and out through various different NGOs that are working in the field. And so, you know, part of the problem that I've seen, at least in a disaster context, is the consistency of the workforce, their relative knowledge of quality coming into the program. Sometimes they're coming from medical schools, sometimes they're coming as practitioners that have been in the field for 20 years. So there's an inconsistency in their medical knowledge and in routine capturing of data, and that you've seen that all over the place. And then I think when you look at M&E volunteers or monitoring and evaluation volunteers, you know, an accountant per se that could come in and say, okay, I'm going to do the record keeping, et cetera. But in a chaos situation where you are seeing more patients than you probably could ever see in any normal circumstance, and then also looking at a volunteer workforce that doesn't have the capacity, you know, was just basically thrown in, flew in at 8 a.m. and just started seeing patients at 9 straight off from the car, you know, you don't have the ability to train that workforce, especially when they're going to be there for 3 days, 5 days to do orthopedic surgeries, and that's where their skill is, and that's what you want to maximize their use. You know, again, these are very large constraints, especially in a developing world context, and especially in the case of disaster relief. So, you know, what I would contend is that, you know, looking at more monitoring and evaluation, you know, capacity building within the countries, and that's, to me, it means actually training people at the Ministry of Health level so that they can supplement the work that NGOs are doing. But again, these are resource constraints within a country that have to be addressed.
That's a wonderful question. And, you know, it really depends. So I've done work as a volunteer, I've done work as a staff member. And it depends what my role is and whether I have the authority. So in Haiti, we found some discrepancies. You know, I mentioned the doctors prescribing. And what I did in that case was I sat down with the head expatriate medical doctor and the head Haitian doctor and showed them the evidence. And the three of us discussed it, and the head Haitian doctor of the hospital decided that he needed to go and that this was an issue. And they decided that they were going to do some additional training of the doctors. So it's really a case-by-case basis. Often I don't have the authority to discipline, but it depends what my role is there. But it's a very, very good question. Sometimes just having the evidence is... Sometimes just having so the case of the missing cotrimoxazole in the Congo, sometimes just having the data was enough that those staff realized that I was paying attention and I didn't have any problems going into the future, right? And that was a very innocuous little conversation with them, right? That was very casual, like, oh, really? Gee, for the past 3 months, your usage hasn't been anything like that. Isn't this mysterious? You know, same number of patients, your usage tripled. Doesn't make sense to me. And they didn't try it again.
Community groups.
Well, I mean, I wish I had, I think, a very concrete, actionable response for you, but I would say that, you know, partly what I'd like to see in my world of, you know, product donations utopia is rational drug use training, which is something that's been going on and who one of the groups, Management Science for Health in Boston, has done extremely well, but it needs to, I think, be scaled up to folks that actually work in disasters. So that's really just training people that work in the NGO field, that volunteer, that that accept and shouldn't accept, perhaps in certain cases, product donations. So, you know, that's really looking at, you know, what's appropriate. I mean, again, following the guidelines. WHO guidelines are clear. You know, it should have 12-month dating when it arrives in country. I think people often tend to think, especially when they're working in those circumstances, well, I'll be able to use it in a month, even if it has just 3 months dating. Or it's expired, but it's probably still good for a year. So some of that thinking just needs to be eradicated, because what you wouldn't do here in the U.S. or in any Western country shouldn't be done anywhere else. You know, how do you train church groups to know what's appropriate in a product donation? A lot of this, you know, just points to education, and it's I think that the burden, or it's incumbent upon the recipient of this donated product to either say, I won't accept product with less than 12 months dating, and that is the responsibility of the NGO or the group that's working in country. And part of that, again, is education and really reaching out to folks as a part of an education campaign. One of the best examples that I've seen is France, who works with an organization called Tulip, tulip.org. And they have gone into a public, a mass public education campaign and saying what's appropriate, what's not appropriate in any disaster situation in any country. And so they have done this large-scale mass population public service announcements, and they run them pretty much 4 times a year, and especially after a disaster. I mean, I think that there's a lot to be learned from an initiative like this on a broader scale, and I think there's a lot to be learned in the U.S. on teaching folks that want to give. It's not okay to give, you know, your leftover X, you know, Viagra from your medicine cabinet in a disaster situation. It was prescribed to you for a specific use, for a specific, you know, for a specific design. So partly I think it's educating the public that's also donating. Right? Because it's not just pharmaceuticals and health manufacturers that are donating. It's often you, me, and everyone else.
So I'm just going to add really quickly that it's partly your responsibility. So after the Haiti earthquake, everybody I spoke to, I told them what they should or shouldn't donate. And I said, don't send medicines. Don't send bottles of water. It's ridiculous. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us to just spread the word whenever this happens.
Well, I think for the U.S., I think the first step is really to recognize it's an issue, and I think that it's not really given the recognition that it deserves, and in order for it to be addressed in terms of healthcare reform. I mean, it's really kind of unclear, and it's really unknown that there really is a problem of underuse in the minority communities, and I think that's the first step for social activists or anyone really interested in health equity, is to recognize that's an issue. And in terms of what sort of policies they can advocate for, I think the regulatory, you really have to, goes back to law enforcement, and you have to regulate pharmacies distributions. If we find that, you know, first you have to understand the problem, which we really don't. We know that it is a problem, but why it's a problem, that's still really unclear. So kind of promoting research in that area, I think, is a first step. And secondly, encouraging and promoting policy that looks at factors such as pharmacies, their distributions. I mean, a lot of the pharmacies in the U.S. are retail, they're corporate. And their distribution in communities is really regulated, not unregulated by, you know, the government. So they can decide where is it more profitable to place a Walgreens or a CVS, right? And that's where they place them. They don't place them in communities where the majority of the population is on Medicaid. Reimbursement rates are low. It's not profitable. So things like that, I think, is where the activism should be, to recognize it's an issue, why it's an issue, and hold people accountable for it, the government and retail pharmacies, corporations, and kind of understanding its role in health outcomes longitudinally or over time, I think would improve our chances of making it recognized by the government and the corporations.
So there are lots of answers to your question, so I'll just try a couple of quick ones. First of all, I don't think the donations are the answer to very much, except in cases of catastrophes like the earthquake in Haiti. For the rest of it, we need to be looking at what are the reasons why that pharmaceuticals are not getting to places where they're needed. One of the reasons I think is because we have chosen to focus more on intellectual property rights than on human rights. So that the example of that is the WTO actually is a structure that has real power, that if you're a member of the WTO and you don't go along with the regulations and the treaties that it enforces, there are serious consequences, especially for smaller countries in terms of trade restrictions. Whereas with the WHO really has very little power to do anything, and in fact that power is being eroded as the budget is the amount of the expenses of the WHO that comes from dues is going down, and the directed donations from various either governments or organization like Gates goes up, and those really take away a lot of the power from the WHO because those directed donations are for specific projects that are not chosen on the basis necessarily of international need, but are on the basis of what the donors think is best, the best way to use their money. So I think that we need to be looking at a serious rebalancing of who has power and how that power is being used. And that's easy to say, but quite difficult to do.
We have two or three other questions here too. So I think this lady is first. Okay. And could you come up also from the back so that you, because you'll need to speak at the microphone.
I had another question for Veronica because I was looking at her donations and seeing that most of what you're looking at is sort of the manufacturer level, which I think is a lot easier to regulate than I think what my colleague here was talking about with the private level donations. I was also in Haiti and was working with an NGO there who had received an entire a container full of medical supplies, and when we opened it up and moved it into the warehouse there, which is a school,
we can definitely talk for hours, but I'll try and keep this really brief. And I don't know that I'm going to add anything to my previous response other than to say there's a great deal of education that needs to take place. I think the concept of even trying to study private level donations is almost like trying to do population-based research. I mean, I think the task is immense. My particular study looked specifically at pharmaceutical donations from the manufacturers in a very sort of tight environment of specific companies and specific NGOs. But what I would say overall is that the education needs to not limit itself to that sort of group where it's a controlled environment. Private donations are a huge responsibility of on a population based. But I would also say that, you know, I'd like to add just the notion of health disparities. You know, a lot of what, you know, health disparities are not sort of central to the U.S. I mean, they expand out. And a lot of these populations are in great need and have subpar health infrastructure even before a disaster happens. I mean, I think, you know, to Joe's point, donations is not the answer, but they're happening, and they're happening in large numbers. And so I think a part of our responsibility is looking particularly first at what we, at the end, keeping the end in mind. So if we want increased and better health outcomes, how do we move back from that to educate forward? So.
I'd also like to add that in the case of the United States, there's a huge underlying incentive that is not addressed by education, which is the tax deductions that people get from throwing all that crap into boxes, sending it off where you have to deal with it, and they take it as a tax deduction. And that is a major underlying issue for the American market. I think we've overgone our time, but that's...
I'm an RN and I work at night, and of course in the hospital I can easily dispense the prescribed drugs that my patient needs. At the same time, I'm a community health worker where even though how much I follow up the clients and the research, the CBPR that I'm doing, that my clients would say, ask them that, oh, 2 weeks ago your blood pressure everything was maintained. What happened? Oh, because I only took half of the dose. I have it in the, one in the morning, one at night. I said, why? You see, I don't have insurance. I don't have the money to pay for the prescriptions. All this kind of whole story, you already was able to come up and make up with that. My point here is the drug industry controls the healthcare for all. The drug industry is not really for benefit. Not for the healthcare workers, nor the patients. It is for the world, Wall Street. So in every drug, can be, if you take it generic, it will not cost as much as 100-fold or 2.9-fold the price because of all those overhead expenses. The thing that I always see in the hospital is, you know, the giveaways, the parties, that all these drug agents are doing, just to have to push the drug. Now, this drug comes in so many names, which is azithromycin, I don't know how many brands. So, my point here is, I don't know, how much can we work on nationalizing the drug industry? Because drug industry controls the world. Drug industry oppresses the world. Now, how are we going to address that as public health?
Thank you. I think that was more of a statement than a question, and an excellent statement. And we also had questions here because many of us are public health activists and would like to see things change. And Joel is talking about how the World Trade Organization has more muscle than any of the other agencies we're talking about there that we've been discussing here, and that the focus is on intellectual property rights, which is the protection of industry. I think what we need to do as activists who are concerned about public health, are concerned about access and disparities, are concerned about public safety, is we need to lobby. It does not help just to say bad things about the pharmaceutical industry. You know, I have one representative from the pharmaceutical industry who literally wouldn't come today. You know, she did work, but she wouldn't come. We need to be lobbying with our governments and internationally as well, so that we have as much muscle put behind consumer safety and equitable access to really essential drugs, because there's an enormous amount of wastage here. I'm sorry, I'm answering the question. No, no. It wasn't even a question. But so we agree with you, I think, and anybody who's interested in this and would give us business cards so we put you on a list. The traffic will be light, but we just want to keep a dialogue going on about these issues. And I have, yes, this man has been waiting to ask a, no? No? You sure? Yes. Yeah, there was a malaria expert who spoke in Ottawa last week, and he said the estimate now is that 50% of the malaria drugs coming into Africa are counterfeit or substandard, which of course is just losing the battle against malaria. And we have no way, if something counterfeit comes into Nigeria, there's no way for Nigeria to take any action against the company in China that it came from. No global regulation about that, but there is intellectual property rights. But again, I think we will waste our efforts if we just criticize the drug industry. Our governments should be doing something about this.
Do you want to mention some of the people doing access to medicine campaigns?
Please do. And also, just again, tomorrow there's a session by the Trade and Health at 10:30, which is worth attending.
Okay, so really quickly, I'm sorry your colleague has left, but there are several groups that are doing international campaigns on access to medicines. Doctors Without Borders has a very large campaign. They do have a project out of their New York office. It's called Access to Essential Medicines, if you look. One World Health in California is trying to develop medicines for neglected diseases. There's also the DNDI is something rather neglected disease industry. There's a group I've worked with called Health Action International in Amsterdam. They've done a really interesting study on medicine prices, www.haiweb.org/medicine-prices. And they've done studies of prices of 30 different medicines in countries around the world and compared what it would cost to buy one treatment regimen compared to the salary of the lowest paid government worker. And they've discovered that, say, a course of antibiotics, you have to work 20 minutes in Switzerland and you have to work 5 days in a country in sub-Saharan Africa. So there are people that are looking at this access issue, and those are just some places to start looking.
There's also another group, which I don't think you mentioned, Healthy Skepticism.
No, I forgot that.
Yeah, Healthy Skepticism works on the kind of advertising, the marketing that is done, which distorts the information we have about which drugs are actually good and which are not.
And which diseases need medicines.
Yeah, yeah. And I will, tomorrow's session in Trade and Health, I'm doing a presentation on market failures and distortions in the pharmaceutical, global pharmaceutical industry. So a lot of these issues we're talking about. Thank you all very much. Did you have a question? No? Thank you for staying so long. And please, business cards from anybody who'd like to be on our list. Low traffic, you can always put delete. Thank you.